In the second hour, we'll continue with Anatomy of a Sacrifice Zone, the documentary that you have been listening to. First, however, an item of concern for listeners who live in the 27th Congressional District, which includes the counties of Ontario, Seneca, Wayne, and parts of Cayuga, including the city of Auburn. The week before last on the program, we aired a documentary on the Arctic Wildlife Refuge and the designs that the oil industry has on it. Outgoing President Clinton was begged to declare it a national monument so as to prevent its destruction, but he did not, leaving it vulnerable to despoliation by act of Congress. And guess what? Our so-called representative in the 27th District, Tom Reynolds, has announced he plans on leading the charge to despoil it for oil industry profits. Now, of course, that's not how he describes it. Here's what the Buffalo News reported on January 12th in an article by staff writer Jay Ray. One day after President Clinton decided against designating a 19-million-acre Alaskan refuge as a national monument, a local member of Congress announced his support for oil drilling on that land to help reduce home heating costs. Representative Thomas M. Reynolds, Republican Clarence, is pressing to open 1.5 million acres within the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska for oil drilling. An estimated 16 billion barrels of oil lies beneath a flat tract of Arctic desert on Alaska's coastal plain, enough oil to replace all imports from Saudi Arabia for the next 30 years, Reynolds said Thursday at his Amherst office. And I believe we can get that oil safely and responsibly, unquote. Environmentalists have urged Clinton to declare the 19-million-acre refuge a national monument before he leaves office next week to block energy companies from drilling for oil and natural gas in the area. Clinton said he opposes drilling in the refuge, but said the area is protected by federal law that prevents drilling unless approved by Congress. On Thursday, Reynolds said he plans to co-sponsor legislation asking President, quote, elect George W. Bush to support the proposal to drill on the refuge. Bush, a former Texas oil man, has made giving energy companies drilling access to the refuge's 1.5 million acre coastal plain a key part of his national energy policy, so the United States is less dependent on foreign oil imports. The U.S. now relies on foreign imports for 56% of its crude oil, Reynolds said. The Department of Energy estimates that that number will climb to 65% by 2020, he said. Clinton's decision not to designate the land a national monument is, quote, one less roadblock, unquote, Reynolds said. First and foremost, this country needs a comprehensive energy policy to address the high cost of gasoline and home heating, something that's been lacking in the outgoing administration, unquote, he said. Yes, the country needs a comprehensive energy policy. However, according to Colin Campbell, an oil geologist with 35 years' experience, who has published a paper available on the web, essentially, optimistic comments such as Reynolds are based on faulty interpretations of the data. In a recently published paper, Campbell writes, quote, our analysis of the discovery and production of oil fields around the world suggests that within the next decade, the supply of conventional oil will be unable to keep up with the demand. This conclusion contradicts the picture that one gets from oil industry reports, which boasted of 1,020 billion barrels of oil in proved reserves at the start of 1998. Dividing that figure by the current production rate of about 23.6 billion barrels of oil a year might suggest that crude oil could remain plentiful and cheap for 43 more years, probably longer because official charts show reserves growing. Unfortunately, this appraisal makes three critical errors. First, it relies on distorted estimates of reserves. A second mistake is to pretend that production will remain constant. Third and most important, conventional wisdom erroneously assumes that the last bucket of oil can be pumped from the ground just as quickly as the barrels of oil gushing from wells today. In fact, the rate at which any well or any country can produce oil always raises to a maximum and then, when about half the oil is gone, begins falling gradually back to zero. From an economic perspective, when the world runs completely out of oil is thus not directly relevant. What matters is when production begins to taper off. Beyond that point, prices will rise unless demand declines commensurately. Using several different techniques to estimate the current reserves of conventional oil and the amount still left to be discovered, we conclude that the decline will begin before 2010. And I repeat, from Colin Campbell, Oil Geologist's paper, we conclude that the decline will begin before 2010. If Reynolds actually cares about the price of energy his constituents are facing, he will concentrate his efforts on a real energy policy, the development of wind, biomass, solar, and other non-petroleum-based sources. If you want to tell Reynolds to get a clue, as I plan to do, you can call his office in Victor at area code 716-742-1600, that's 716-742-1600, or send him a letter. You can access his various office locations for mail by going to the web at www.house.gov/Reynolds, www.house.gov/Reynolds. Now we continue with Oxford, New Jersey, Anatomy of a Sacrifice Zone.
Thomas Janda was employed for 5 years as an environmental enforcement officer by the Pollution Control Financing Authority, the public body responsible for county waste management. He is now suing the PCFA under provisions of the whistleblower laws. Because of his pending lawsuit, he was unable to address or elaborate on certain aspects of his experiences. We asked Tom Janda if the methods for screening out dangerous items were effective.
In my 5 years of being enforcement for PCFA, I found that the checking of the waste is almost next to impossible. You can watch one truck at a time. Usually they'll only have one person watching the waste coming out of the back of the truck. And it comes out at tons at a time. And there's only so much that you can see in that as the ram from the truck is pushing the waste into the pit. You can only see so much. In the course of the time that I was there, like I said before, the only time that I saw that things were stopped was if they felt that the contents would not fit into the ram into before it gets pushed into the burner. If it was a chemical, if it was a container with liquid, it usually got broken open in the packer truck because it gets compacted in the packer truck. Or as it's dumping out, you really don't get to see it, and when the big claw comes down from the ceiling to grapple all the garbage and bring it up to the hopper, it'll get crushed in there. If it survives that, it then goes into the ram and gets pushed into the burner, and it will burn up inside the burner. Like I said, I've seen many times when variety of sizes of liquids would come in and there's basically nothing you can do. You can't go out and get it. Occasionally they would bring down the claw to grab something, and if it's non-breakable, such as a long piece of metal pipe or something, they can grab that and maybe put it off to the side. But if it's something that's soft or something that can be crushed, they don't jump somebody out into the pit and go get it. They would rather just leave it there and send it up, and what they don't see doesn't hurt them. During the 5 years I was there, you had at most two people. One person that worked for the incinerator, for Ogden Martin, that was basically in charge of moving the trucks. His job was to make sure that the trucks moved in and out safely. His job really wasn't to monitor the waste, because he was too busy with safety factors. The person they would have there would be one person, if they were lucky, from the authority. And like I said before, if you have five or six trucks, you can maybe monitor two, watch two dump, but you've got two that are standing right next to you dumping tons of garbage into this pit at a time. There's no way that you can spot waste that could be hazardous. There would be never a time that the operation would stop and somebody would go and get something that they thought was hazardous and pull it out. Health effects, I wasn't exposed as much as, say, the employees of the incinerator itself. My job was a good percentage of the time, maybe 98% of the time, I was out on the road monitoring solid waste haulers. So the times that I would go to the pit, though, we would wear gas masks that had filters, double filters in them, that would protect us from dust and some fluids that would be in the air. We would wear gloves if we were going to be if we had a truck that we were going to examine the waste. We would dump it on the floor and we would pull apart pieces of waste out of the truck, out of the piles that would hit the floor. It was a rarity as far as I was concerned, because, like I said, I was mainly out on the road. The person that was responsible for it was supposed to pull at least one small packer truck, at least I believe once a day, pull one of the trucks aside and dump them on the floor. I would say you'd be looking at better than 30 trucks, packer trucks, 20 to 30 packer trucks per day, and maybe on the tractor trailer load trucks, the tractor trailers, maybe better than 10 a day. And along with the tractor trailer trucks, those could not ever be dumped, because the pit area, the dump area, is not long enough for the waste to be kept in the building. And that was a mandate, as far as I was told, that the waste, if we had to inspect it, it had to be inside the building on the floor, and then we could inspect it. But there were so many tractor trailers that were coming in from Somerset, Hunterdon, and now I hear from other counties, maybe even other states, that they're coming in by tractor trailer loads. And these are, I believe, better than 60 cubic yards of solid waste. And there's no room to dump them and inspect them. So all they can do is back them up to the pit and let the floor walk the trash out. The job title was called Fuel Quality Inspector. And I believe the job required at least one inspection of one of the haulers per day. And we had various companies, so each company would not know when their truck was going to be inspected. As we tipped it on the floor, if there were any violations, I never saw any violations being typed up by the authorities, attorneys, in reference to bad material being brought in. The only time I would ever see someone pull something from or make an effort is if the small batteries from like a radio or a camera, the C and D cell type batteries, if they were ever on the floor, if they happened to miss going into the pit, somebody might kick it off to the side and eventually it might get put in a bucket that was to be sent out for recycling or to be sent out as hazardous waste. But it was rare. I mean, the few that you would see hit the floor only made my mind think that, well, how many am I missing? That because they're so small and there's so many tons of waste passing by your eyes at one time, There's no way that you can see all this stuff. How many people out there use these green-colored plastic bags, or gray color, whatever color they're using, even the clear? You can only see so much, the outside presence. And like I said, you've got so many tons, 2-3 tons passing your eyes at one time. You'd have to be Superman to see through all this waste, to see what's wrong with it. Is covered with dust. There is no way that you can get away from it. Like I mentioned before, with the waste that's in the pit, a big grapple on a constant basis, if the grapple is not loading up the two hoppers to be sent down for burning, I believe his next assignment is to be fluffing up the waste. And as he's fluffing up the waste, you can't stop the dust. It's just impossible. And they've got to keep it dry so it'll burn properly. It's not like they can dampen it and keep the dust particles down. If you go to the top of the incinerator, where the grapple operator works, that entire place is covered with dust. They cannot keep that place clean. There is no way, because of the amount and the thickness of dust. Matter of fact, he has to stay in a special air-conditioned room so that he can operate the grapple. Because he's there constantly. Maybe that's one of the reasons why they put him in a special sealed room, so he's not exposed to the dangers of the waste that's going into the incinerator. After I was there for approximately a year, we received, all of us that were going to be exposed to the pit area or the inside internal workings of the incinerator, we were sent out for health exams, which included our breathing, our blood work, to test for mercury, lead, different items that might be in our system, to give a baseline. And we were supposed to receive, what I was told by the authority, that we were going to receive every year a physical of the exact same, so they could monitor us. And even after we were either left the job or terminated from the job, that we were still supposed to be monitored for forever, so they could see the ill effects, if there were any, being developed. I had the one physical, and that's the only one I've ever received in 5 years.
Liz Marshall and Dave McNulty have lived in Mountain Lake for the past 5 years. Their son William, now 16 months old, was born with spinal meningitis and severe eczema. Liz and Dave explain how they became involved in the fight against the incinerator.
Not long after we moved here, we had a hard time figuring out what to do with our garbage. Our landlord didn't know. So eventually we tracked it down, and we were told where the landfill was. So I went one day to the landfill. There's this big sign outside of the road that leads to the landfill that says Warren County Resource Recovery Facility. And I thought, well, what's that? And then the cynical side of me thought, well, I don't know what it is, but whatever it is, it's not a resource recovery facility. They came up with some kind of strange name. And so we sort of pursued it a little bit. I made a couple calls, found out it was an incinerator. I think I called the Warren County Health Department, talked to somebody about who looks after it, who monitors it. This is knowing nothing about the history of it. I was just concerned. My antenna went up. And they referred me to somebody at Ogden Martin, and I called over there. I think I called the PR department, and they sent out a big fat envelope filled with glossy materials extolling the virtues of garbage incineration. So, I guess you know, we didn't do much about it at that point until we met up with a couple other people who had actually been fighting it from the beginning. So that's when it all kind of came together, and we decided to try to do something about it. I didn't really believe what they were saying, that you could burn garbage and there could be absolutely no pollution effects whatsoever. I mean, I just didn't believe that, you know, and that's basically what the literature was saying. And, you know, there was nothing, there was no criticism of whatsoever. Of course, it was published by the company, and but it just kind of makes you, you know, we're sort of in the media / PR business, and it just makes you wonder what's going on when you get a piece of literature like that in the mail. There's heavy metals coming out of the stack. There's dioxin. There's small particulate matter that gets in the lungs and you know, causes all kinds of health problems. And on top of it, it's a crazy financial situation. It's a total economic black hole for this county, and it doesn't make any sense for our future. We're burning up garbage that we could be recycling, and we're wasting resources, and you know, this is the legacy that we're leaving for our children. You know, it's a total fiasco. He's a big healthy baby when he was born, although within a couple weeks or maybe about a month or so, he developed pretty severe skin problems, eczema, to the point that it was, you know, like lesions on his face. It was not little dry patches. It was very, you know, visible, you know, painful for him, very itchy. He was up all night. You know, a lot of newborns are anyway, but he was particularly irritated by it. And then at the age of 3 months, he came down with a severe case of bacterial meningitis. It was a strain of meningitis, which is not particularly uncommon. It's pneumococcal, which is a bacteria that's found everywhere, and for some reason it's not completely rare, but it's somewhat uncommon. It invades a baby's nervous system. So he was in the hospital for 2 weeks with that, and I don't really know if it had anything directly to do with the incinerator. It certainly had something to do, I would imagine, with a weakened immune system. Eczema is sort of a sign of a weaker immune system.
I don't have any doubt at all that this incinerator is a deadly thing. You know, the way that these things affect the health of the neighborhoods where they're put in has been made very, I think, they've been very careful to not be able to trace the effects definitively to one source. It's sort of the nature of pollution and the whole legal and economic structure in this country these days, is that they can put these things up and send all kinds of pollution into our environment, but unless we can prove in a court of law that it's exactly coming from that stack and that we suffer a concrete disease and a definite condition that is definitely traced to one single source, we're left out in the cold. And when we go and talk to people like the freeholders of this county, they don't really care about the health of the people in the county. When we bring these issues to their attention, they're annoyed by us. They treat us like we're troublemakers, third-class citizens. And they'll say, yeah, you have the freedom to speak your mind, and we have the freedom to ignore everything that you're saying, regardless of how many EPA studies we cite, how many authorities on incineration we cite, how many people we offer to bring in to speak to them, how much information we put in front of them over years and years and years. They don't want to hear it, because basically what happens is it's an economic structure. They've got too much money invested in this. They've committed too much of the taxpayers' money to really come to grips with something as trivial as health issues. What do they care if this county has the highest cancer rate in a state that has among the highest cancer rates in the country? you know, they don't care, and they don't want to hear about that, and they don't want to have to take the responsibility to change it. I am really concerned, though, about growing up here.
Yeah.
I mean, we've just bought a house, and we're here fighting this thing. And, you know, I can tell you that if we don't succeed in closing this thing down in just a handful of years, I don't want to live here. You know, I don't mind sticking it out and fighting and trying to close it down for the sake of us and everybody else in this county. But if I have an option to get away from it, I will. The problem is, these days, you never know what you're moving into. You know, we moved out to this rural area from Jersey City, which is supposed to be the nasty, polluted, cancerous, ugly place among, you know, places. It's the butt of all jokes from all over the world. People know Jersey City and Newark as a place to avoid because of all kinds of bad things. So we moved out to beautiful rural Warren County, New Jersey, with rolling hills and cows and horses and trees, thinking, oh, this is a great place to live. It's got to be healthy. Breathe that air. And sure enough, we find out we moved to within a couple miles of this incredibly deadly polluting incinerator. And so, and then we find out that Warren County has the highest cancer rate per capita. Per capita, it's really astounding. And when you bring it up, it's like it's the emperor's new clothes. It's, you know, don't say it. You know, don't rain on our parade. It's really an ostrich mentality. They say they're powerless to do anything about it, and their story has changed over time. The more we learn about what actually the arrangements are, we catch them in lies and misrepresentations again and again. And at each juncture when we catch them in a lie, they change their story about why they can't shut it down. At first they denied that there were any health effects. After we nailed them to the wall with their own state statistics, with the fact that the Environmental Protection Agency of New Jersey ignored over 500 violations at this incinerator, that the EPA itself, the federal EPA, lists dioxin as a major health risk in the country, and they also say that a huge percentage, 80% or so of all the dioxin in this country comes from waste incinerators, and a good bit of it comes from municipal solid waste incinerators, which this is a perfect example. So after we nail them on all those things, then they say, well, okay, we're not going to talk about health anymore because we've been nailed. The reason we can't shut it down is that we owe too much money on it. And when you point out that, in fact, legally, as we found out, that the law of New Jersey says that counties cannot be held responsible for bonds such as the one issued to support this incinerator, then they tell us that they've signed a special agreement that guarantees a certain amount of waste to the incinerator. So they've been aware of all these issues all the way along, and only as we reveal their lies do they change their story and we get further into it. And really what the conclusion is that they're out to protect this industry, they're out to protect their own butts, and the last concern on their list is the concern of the health of the people of this county.
From a moral point of view, from a environmental point of view, from a financial point of view, the incinerator makes no sense, and it never has. And why do we keep, you know, supporting it? Why do our politicians keep supporting the status quo as we have it? It makes no sense. And in my opinion,
the only sense that it makes, really, after you turn it around and around, is that there's money flowing in a particular direction, and it's far easier for a small number of people to protect that money flow than it has been for a large number of people who have suffering the ill effects from it to come up against that structure and get them to shut it down. A couple weeks ago, there was something in the newspaper about us doing our thing, and there was a picture, and I went into a little diner that I go into all the time, and somebody had seen the picture in the paper, and this woman who I interact with all the time said, oh, I saw your picture in the paper. And I thought to myself, okay, what's she going to think of it? And so I just said, oh, yeah, that was a terrible picture, wasn't it? And she said, she whispered, she said, you know, what you're doing, I think it's really great. I don't like the incinerator either. Keep up the good work. And I thought, this is it. This is what's happening. You know, all these people know that they've been screwed. They know that they're being killed by this thing. But the system that we live in has been so successful at cowing people and reducing human beings into quivering masses of apathy and paralysis that people aren't even able to act on what they know is the truth. And, I mean, if I would have said to that woman, you know what? You can do it too. She would have been both stunned and petrified at the thought that she might have to actually go out and raise her voice to save her life.
We asked Liz and Dave what advice they would give to young families who wanted to move to Warren County.
Come out and fight.
Come out and save the last beautiful rural frontier of New Jersey. I mean, it sounds like almost like a joke that there's a rural area in New Jersey, but there is, and it's here, and it's going to disappear, you know, and we need to save it.
It's a big job, because it's always far easier to foul something up than it is to keep it clean, you know. All it takes is a couple people to mess something up, but it takes a lot of people to protect it. These public officials lie, straight out lie, about emissions of dioxin. They cover things up. They give us wrong information. They go to these corporation-sponsored events and resorts in Florida to talk about how to deal with public opposition. And when you bring these things up, it's like you just didn't say anything. It's like you're not even there in the room. It's like you're transparent and nobody can hear what you're saying. It's like some weird dream, you know? And you're just being irrational and, you know, just calm down and you know, be nice, sit down, obey the rules. And here they are destroying the place that we live in. It's common sense turned upside down. Everything, this whole thing is completely backwards.
According to some waste technology experts, when communities choose not to recycle, but to burn, when they choose not to reuse resources, but to landfill them, when they choose technological band-aids over responsible and ethical action, they are burdened with a variety of highly concentrated, toxic residues and an entirely new set of pollution and disposal problems. Disposing of these residues, according to the experts, results in problems many times greater than associated with the original substance or product. For example, leachate is a toxic liquid produced when rainwater percolates through acres of landfilled material. The wastewater treatment plant in the Oxford area treats the leachate from the Oxford landfill. The treatment process relies on bacteria to consume organic waste. It was recently disclosed that the leachate from the Oxford landfill is becoming too toxic and is killing the bacteria. The Oxford landfill contains, among other hazardous material, the toxic ash from the incinerator. In a desperate attempt to control the amount of leachate produced, the Pollution Control Financing Authority is proposing to install a giant 14-acre plastic tarp to cover the entire landfill. Last summer, a pipe connecting the landfill with the treatment plant ruptured, reportedly spilling more than 30,000 gallons of toxic leachate into a stream which feeds into the Pequest River. The Pequest River, in turn, feeds directly into the Delaware River, a source of drinking water for more than 10 million people. Children living on the farm next to the contaminated stream were found to have alarmingly high levels of cadmium in their blood. The leachate spill also sickened a dozen cows on that same farm. The farmer, Jim Popenko, was advised by his attorneys not to speak with us due to his pending lawsuit over the leachate spill. an effort to save landfill space, the PCFA agreed to ship incinerator ash to Elizabeth, New Jersey, for use in road paving materials. Warren County, however, refused to use the ash on its own roads. Reverend Joseph Parrish is rector of St. John's Episcopal Church in Elizabeth, New Jersey. Reverend Parrish was instrumental in fighting the use of the Oxford incinerator ash as a paving material on the study in medical sciences and biochemistry from Harvard University.
The ash has to be tested. First of all, it used to just landfill it or dump it any place in the environment. Now you have to retest the ash, test each lot of ash, as a matter of fact, and to show whether it does or doesn't contain hazardous chemicals. And in general, it is above the hazardous chemical limits on many contaminants, namely lead, chromium, arsenic, and mercury. So it has some of the most deadly contents of what comes out of the waste stream possible. It's concentrated in the ash. Any time somebody takes a fluorescent tube and turns it on, you think that's great, you're saving electricity. However, 25 of those 2-3 foot tubes can kill it has enough mercury to kill an average adult human. And when you throw it into the incinerator, it just goes right up the stack. It doesn't stop. It just volatilizes it, and we breathe it. And children, particularly, have greatly impaired mobility, gait. They don't walk sometimes until they're 3 years old, that sort of thing. So it's dramatic what happens around these communities where they have these incinerators. Mercury is poisons each and every child in that area. So the lead is particularly impacting on children under 6. That's the children whose nervous systems are developing. They're learning to speak, to talk, to think. And it just confuses the neuronal connections as their brain develops. And they become permanently impaired. It is irreversible. The child that has been lead poisoned is never, IQ drops tremendously below 100, and you cannot recover the intelligence quotient of children who have been lead poisoned. Sometimes, of course, they die. We have the United Parents Against Lead in the state of New Jersey. It's a national organization, and the head of the New Jersey United Parents Against Lead, her child was first diagnosed with cerebral palsy and then some kind of neurological deficit, and finally when he died and they did an autopsy, he had been lead poisoned. And of course she's a major activist now, telling other parents that when your child is, the behavior pattern seems off and somehow they can't diagnose what's wrong with the child, test the lead levels. And sometimes if you catch it soon enough, you can stop the progression of the lead toxicity. And there are chelating agents that they can infuse into the child, which will capture the lead and take it out of their body. But you have to catch it soon, otherwise the child is permanently impaired. And we have, of course, a great epidemic throughout New Jersey, particularly Newark, Camden, New Brunswick, Elizabeth, of lead poisoning. When you pave a roadway with asphalt, you go to any asphalt-paved roadway, and how long does it last? Maybe a year, maybe 6 months in urban areas, maybe a year and a half. Depends on how much salting is done, freeze and thawing cycles. But asphalt crumbles, and as it crumbles, it forms dust. And whatever happens to be in the asphalt contained in that dust, you breathe. And that's the way any toxins which go into pavement are ingested by everybody in the community. And in this area in Elizabeth, we're very concerned because already the roads are starting to crumble and crack. And when you have to recycle the roadway. Well, if you have lead ash in your road surface and you recycle it, you just build up the lead content in every asphalt pavement from there until eternity. You know, so once you introduce it into any roadway and then start carrying it statewide, it is a terrible threat, a hazard. In Elizabeth, the levels are 4 to 10 times higher than the ambient, the high levels of many urban areas. So that's after it's been diluted by asphalt. It has a huge burden of lead. And that adds to already the threat to children's lives from the lead dust of their houses, the lead dust in the roadways from the leaded gasoline, and the lead solder and the lead pipes that children and we all drink from the older plumbing. So we already have three sources of lead, and now we're adding a fourth. It is a sure death plan to me. It's just such a threat to the life and health and well-being of everybody, not just children, but everybody is going to be is affected by this. And it as the states start to expand this use of the incinerator ash to use that for asphalt roadways, we're going to have another lead epidemic. We've finally gotten the children's lead levels below 10 micrograms per deciliter, and we're less statewide, but this is going to push them back again, and a severe mental retardation occurs when you get above the level of 10. In our area, they're running 6 to 7. They finally came down that, but it's this: if they start paving the roadways in Union County, and as they will in the rest of the state, the lead levels will start rising quickly, and the children will be affected. It is the most expensive way to get rid of garbage is to burn it. Incineration is the most expensive way to get rid of any waste in the environment. But as a result, the pricing is so high that there's a very nice, comfortable profit margin there. But part of that profit margin is eaten away if you have a residue of your burning that you can't just landfill, and that's exactly what happens when they have these 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 parts per million lead. They can't just landfill that. The landfills will not accept it. It's hazardous. So if you could come up with a scheme whereby you can get people to say, oh, we want that, we can mix that with asphalt, and suddenly you lost that cost part of the equation, and your profit just is nice and plump again. So there's definitely an economic advantage if you can get rid of the ash, because it is the burden of all incineration, all the waste, municipal waste incineration is the ash. That's the one thing that when the EPA originally started approving the incinerators, everybody thought it wasn't classified as hazardous. They didn't have to test it. And suddenly, now that the Supreme Court has ruled that each batch of ash must be tested, and in fact what we find is indeed it is hazardous waste, suddenly the cost factor comes in here, and the cost of incineration goes even higher, or if the cost is capped because the tax base won't tolerate it, then the profit margin goes down. So it definitely encourages people who own incinerators to try to find some way to move that out of their, take that liability out of their balance sheet and to put it into somebody's road or do something with it outside of their plant. The results and the health impacts on the communities are just terrible. So once they've authorized the building of an incinerator, then they're stuck. Then they can't say, well, oh, it's okay. What are you going to do with the ash? Well, that has to be okay too. So they back themselves into a corner, and they're simply not to save face. They turn a blind eye as to where that ash goes, and that's becomes our problem as citizens of each community. You're killing kids. So I can say, if you find out the municipal bond is involved in supporting an incinerator, don't buy that municipal bond, because indeed it's probably going to go belly up. In New York and in New Jersey, incinerators are in great difficulty financially. The mayor of Elizabeth and other mayors in Union County have attacked the cost of incineration and the Union County incinerator. They come in with a very low bid, $40-$45 a ton for treatment, and now we're paying over $83 a ton. It's more than doubled in like 2.5 years, and it's like the camel's nose under the tent. Once you get a low ball price in there, then suddenly the sky's the limit, and you can landfill for $40 a ton. So it's ridiculous. We're spending on a half a million tons in Union County a year. We are spending $20 million that we should not be wasting, blowing it up the smokestacks. We could be saving, if we were landfilling and composting it, recycling, reducing, we would save $20 million a year, every year in Union County. And the same holds true in Essex County and Warren County. Tremendous burden on the population. We, in Elizabeth, we need three schools desperately, and we have students sitting on top of each other in closets and everything else, and we desperately need new classroom space. We need three new schools, and there's no money because the people's money is being sucked right out to pay for the garbage waste disposal, and that's ridiculous. I mean, it should be stopped. $20 million a year wasted is just incomprehensible. It's not, there's no way that can be justified. In every community that has an incinerator, millions and millions of dollars that are just being wasted every single year. So economically, it is just a total disaster. We fortunately were able to show the disaster that's happened in Union County and Essex County to the people in Mercer County, and they defeated every single official who was running for election that pushed that incinerator, and they defeated the Mercer County incinerator. And what a wonderful victory that was. So even though we're in here in Warren County and in Union and Essex County, we are suffering the, in Camden County, we're suffering the effects of incineration. At least we saved one county in New Jersey by being the sacrificial lambs. The incinerator, if it's not burning, it's losing money. So they have to keep the thing running as much as they can. So there's no end to the amount of garbage that's needed. So they will burn any. They would burn the dirt around every landfill in the state if people were allowed to do that, just to keep those things burning. They just can't be satiated. There's just no end to the appetite. And, of course, there's the profit motive. I mean, there's $20 million per incinerator per year. I mean, it is a wonderful profit for the owners of each incinerator. So they're highly motivated to keep these things online. There is an alternative. The most rational thing is two of the counties in New Jersey, 100% of their waste goes to municipal compost sites. There's no reason why, there's much more than half of the waste is simply paper. It's ideal for composting. It should not be burned. There's no reason to burn it. Once you burn paper that's white, it's been bleached, it has chlorine, immediately produces dioxin. It just pollutes the entire community. There's no reason that all this huge quantities of waste paper need to be burned. It's just a total waste, and composting is clearly the way to go. And recycling would recover tremendous quantities of very valuable commodities and resources, which are just being burned. And once it's burned, everything is confused in the ash. You can't separate. I mean, there's silver in them, there are things. In the ash, there's silver, 6 milligrams a kilogram of silver. I'm sure there's even gold in it. But once you have it mixed with lead, arsenic, barium, beryllium, cadmium, calcium, chromium, cobalt, copper, iron, lead, whatever, there's no way you can separate out the good stuff. But each one of these, the aluminum, the highest concentration of metals is aluminum. And then you have to burn more trees, more coal to make more aluminum. So it is a total waste of resources to use incineration for any kind of municipal waste or any waste at all. The ash was taken from the municipal waste dumping site in Warren County to an asphalt company, Mount Hope Asphalt. They took it in tarp-covered dump trucks down Route 80 down to Mount Hope, and then the asphalt was produced. Then they trucked the hot asphalt back up to Elizabeth and just dumped it out and rolled it onto the roadway. Now, they did it at 10 o'clock at night, and they did it in the secrecy, and I have been watching what was happening, and just I thought I'd go one last time just to see the untainted roadway. And to my shock, here was about 25 or 30 DEP officials standing out there in their orange hazard waste suits, watching the dump trucks spread this out. And of course, they're all polluted because as they layer this asphalt out, there's crumbling, and it's not packed down or anything. So all the fumes from the asphalt, as well as the lead ash, basically contaminated all the DEP observers. So I hate to say they got their just desserts, but they've been, you know, they were poisoned by their own experiment here.
Frank Leary, a member of the PCFA at the time, on the ash paving project in Elizabeth, New Jersey.
People can shriek, oh my, the only reason people are doing this is in order to salvage the economic problems of the incineration industry. It's crap. The only reason that people wanted to do it was to determine, is this a feasible thing to do? I mean, they chant as if it were some kind of sacred mantra, recycling, recycling, recycling. This is recycling. And is it harmful? We don't know until we try.
The federal authorities and the state authorities are so up to their necks in the incineration problem that they can't figure out how to bail themselves out. They know the answer is stop incineration, but they've approved so many of these incinerators, and now they don't know what to do. So really, they need our help. They need our help. They know the right thing to do is to stop incineration, stop using these byproducts, ash, and other things in the environment. But they need our help, and we have to basically, county by county, say that we do not want incineration used for any of our waste in this county.
Dr. Paul Conant is Director of Work on Waste USA and a professor of chemistry at St. Lawrence University in Canton, New York. He is an internationally recognized authority on waste issues. He spoke recently during a community meeting in Northwest New Jersey.
You know, I define arrogance as ignorance backed up with overconfidence. And we've seen it again and again and again. I mean, and how these people retain their credibility, I don't know. All those people who told us confidently that there would never be major nuclear accidents like Chernobyl, they said it with enormous confidence and ignorance. And they told us that organochlorine pesticides were perfectly safe to use everywhere. When they told us that dioxin was a problem for animals, was not going to be a problem for human beings. They told us incineration was going to be safe. All of these, tremendous confidence, but backing up, essentially, ignorance. They didn't know. And basically, it's been one gigantic experiment. And we, as citizens, have to challenge the right of single-minded, narrow-minded, small-visioned people, so-called experts, to take their expertise and spread it out over democracy and usurp our role. Because I suggest to you that one of the biggest and most dangerous things that we've ever come up with is a group of experts who all share the same value system. Because if they all share the same value system, they can't even see it. It's the way that they see the world. You don't see your glasses until there's a scratch on it. And if you don't have somebody that doesn't have that value, the scratch never becomes visible. Basically, the waste issued tells us that something is wrong. It's the evidence. The waste crisis is the evidence that we are doing something wrong. In industry, it's the visible face of inefficiency. When you make waste, you're not being very efficient. Look at why you're making waste. For society, when we make waste, it's the evidence that we're doing wrong. Now consider what you do with a landfill and what you do with an incinerator with that evidence. You bury the evidence, or you burn the evidence. That's what landfills and incinerators are. They're a way of avoiding the problem. What we've got in New Jersey now, a massive number of communities which are beginning with better leadership to face the problem. They're facing the issue, and they realize it's much more, much bigger than waste. We are living on this planet as if we had another planet to go to. We poison ourselves with leachate from landfills, and we poison ourselves with the air emissions from incinerators and then the ash from incinerators. How do they determine it's safe? They do health risk assessment, which is essentially a prediction, a hypothesis. And one of the tests of a hypothesis to see whether it's scientific or not is to be able to produce an experiment which would disprove the hypothesis. Well, you can't produce an experiment to disprove the hypothesis of a risk assessment. You can't do it. There is no experiment. We are living that experiment. Well, you say, well, what about doing a health study of the community? You've done a health risk, you've assessed what the risks are going to be. Why don't you do a health survey of the communities? And that's a very reasonable idea. And when Dr. Barry Johnson, who's the deputy head of the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, was testifying in Washington in January of 94, he was talking about the possible dangers of incineration. He said, I got my staff to do a computer search of all the papers that have been written on incineration. I went to 10 databases containing over 1 million articles. And he said, we came up with 72,000 articles on incineration. He says, then we cross-checked to see how many of them dealt with the health of the communities which hosted the incinerator. And this could have been a medical waste, hazardous waste, or a trash incinerator. They came back with one. One study out of 72,000 actually dealt with the reality, the human reality, of living near an incinerator. All the rest were theoretical. They were based upon measurements and extrapolations and what have you, the chemistry, the engineering. But in terms of the health of the community, it's not there. So when all those officials were telling people in those five communities and the other communities in New Jersey and the other communities across the United States saying that an incinerator poses no health or environmental threat, that was not science. And I think, well, this is very, very important, because amongst everything else, it says that this industry is going to get away with whatever it can get away with. It's going to minimize its costs at the expense of your health, the expense of the environment. And fine, okay, now we know where they're at. They're just a typical bloody corporation that wants to maximize its profits, minimize its liabilities. Okay, fine, it's out in the open. But don't ever pretend, Ogden Martin, that you are scientific. Don't ever pretend that you've got an environmental solution and that you're environmentally responsible. You're in this to make money, you're in this to make as much money as possible, and if you have to trample over communities, which includes buying off the politicians and ripping the democracy away from under people's noses, then that's fine.
Oxford, New Jersey, Anatomy of a Sacrifice Zone, was written and produced by Bill McLaughlin. Our program was produced at the studios of WNTI in Hackettstown, New Jersey. Digital editing was provided courtesy of LifeSpeed Productions. Original music was composed and performed by Brian Carroll. Our narrator was Mark Goldwert. Funding was provided in part by a grant from the Fund for Investigative Journalism. If you missed any part of this program or would like to hear the complete five-part series, an audio archive can be found at our website at coyotenation.org. This has been a special presentation of Coyote Nation Press, which is solely responsible for its content. I'm June Benes. Thank you for listening. Welcome.
dog here that robbing the rich is for worse or for best. They take it by stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.